It's going to be James. Sure, here it is. See,
it's under, it's 3 seconds to go.
Throws up the floater. Oh, good night, Cleveland. That is for you.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. Carter Rodriguez is on his honeymoon, so the good times are rolling. To replace Carter, we got a special guest, the Dr. Frankenstein to my monster, Conrad Kaczmarek. Oh man, I botched your name. Sorry about that, buddy.
It's okay.
I really feel bad, because for those that don't know, Conrad was the one that first brought me on at Fear the Sword, and is the reason that I am the terrible person I am today. So, Conrad, I'm very, very happy that you are on the podcast.
Wow, I don't feel like I should bear the full responsibility for how terrible of a person you are, but...
You should take responsibility for your actions. But we're not here just to talk about how terrible I am. We're here to talk about how terrible the Toronto Raptors are. The Cleveland Cavaliers have taken a 3-0 lead over the Raptors, with LeBron James hitting yet another game-winning shot. I think I saw a stat that he now has more playoff game winners than Kobe and Jordan combined. Conrad, what were you thinking as LeBron was barreling down the court there?
I don't even know. As I watched it the first time, I guess I don't really even know what I thought he was going to do. I guess I thought he was going to try to go straight to the basket.
That's what I thought too, especially with them not inbounding it like on the Raptors side of the court. I'm like, okay, they want to get LeBron with the head of steam, and he's just going to try to get to the rim and maybe draw a foul.
Yeah, and I think it was a smart move. They've said very openly, like, the reason they did that is so that it's harder to double. I know there's a lot of argument on Twitter after the game from Twitter coaches of how you can double or trap to get the ball out of his hands and when you could have done it. Gosh, it's so hard because it's LeBron James.
I think the answers for stopping LeBron are all on Twitter, and NBA coaches just need to kind of get their phone out in mid-game and look what Twitter is saying there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's clear that all the answers, like you said, are all on Twitter. Everyone knows them except for the guys on the sidelines. Clearly, it's so easy. All you have to do is stand in front of this 6'8". Monster running full speed down the court and leave one of the best shooters of all time in the corner, or something simple like that. It was, I mean, just to be clear, that shot that he hit is ridiculous.
It was like, off his wrong foot. It was crazy.
It's like 15, 20 feet away, one hand off glass. He clearly meant to go off glass. It wasn't like he was just chucking it up there.
Tell that to Skip Bayless.
Yeah, well, that's not worth our time. It's hard to fault, like, oh, they should have trapped here. They got to get the ball out of his hand. First of all, if you trap, he's going to find the open guy. I saw CJ Miles say, like, he thought he did the right thing because he was on Korver, and he did what he said. His reasoning was Korver shooting that wide open three from the corner is way easier than what LeBron did. So.
That is definitely the right call.
So he kind of just chilled and stayed on Korver, which is the right move, because if he had left him, LeBron would have found him, and that's a wide open three for a great shooter. So there weren't a lot of good options, except for making a guy hit a really, really hard shot, but that's what he does.
It's definitely encouraging. You're right. Like, if Korver was left open, LeBron's going to find him, and I still have some PTSD from Korver missing an open three in the finals last year, but I mean, he was so good on that night, and it's nice that Korver and JR really had stepped up in this series, and this was undoubtedly one of, it was JR's worst game of the series. He kind of looked like regular season JR again, but it's good that you still have other guys step up. Korver was sensational. George Hill had another strong game. You would have liked to see him have a few less turnovers, but the refs were really allowing a physical game, and Hill doesn't necessarily have the tightest handle on the planet. So if you're allowed to body him a little bit, I think some of those turnovers are inevitable. And then Kevin Love was the other standout, who his third quarter there with LeBron resting was just absolutely sensational. That's one of the things that the Cavs haven't consistently done, which is run an offense through Kevin Love when LeBron sits. So it's nice to see him be aggressive and really take advantage of those minutes.
Yeah, and I think I remarked this to you on Twitter during the game, where it's nice to see them running the offense through them, but it does also take like a special version of Kevin Love to be able to do that consistently. He's playing like this and he's confident and he's kind of got every part of his game working, where he can get the ball in the post and make score even against non-switches, like against the normal guys that are supposed to be guarding him. When he can still score against them in the post, that opens up so much more, and then they can get the ball into him earlier, so they don't have to like wait until there's a switch, so he has more time on the clock, so even if he doesn't make any progress, they can do something else. Or and then he also has the outside game working, which just makes him so impossibly difficult to guard for basically everybody except for Golden State, which is, I think, a big reason why people don't recognize how good Kevin Love is anymore. It's just, yeah, because a lot of people only watch him in the finals, and that's a really hard matchup, similar to Thad Young in the Indiana series. That's just a bad matchup. But this is a much better matchup. Even Toronto's, in theory, best guys to guard him, at least tonight, had no real chance of guarding him.
Yeah, it's funny. It's almost like we're on the other side of the Al Horford scenario, where we all focus on how Al Horford plays against the Cavs, which is turning into a pumpkin. Whereas against most matchups, he's a hell of a player. The whole Kevin Love thing is interesting to me, because I think that's kind of been one of their biggest failings over the last few years, is the failure to really build a sustainable offense around Love. But at the same time, when you look at it, I don't think that's all on the team, and I don't think that's all on Love. Like, they usually haven't had a backup point guard, which is kind of important for running those lineups. Just constant roster turnover. Love, when he came back from his injury, had 2 weeks left of the regular season and hadn't played with any of the new guys. And it's not weird for there not to be any chemistry there. It's just one of those things where I don't think it's on any one person, but it sure would have been nice to kind of have those sets and get him more comfortable earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, he's a really, really talented guy, and he's a really good scorer. He's just not that like top tier kind of guy where he just dominates regardless of matchup. Who's on the court playing against him and who's on the court with him matters a lot more than like some of these like kind of top tier superstars like LeBron. So they just haven't, but the problem is that they have to build their whole team around LeBron. So
right.
They don't get to spend a lot of time and energy building it around like a sub team around Kevin Love, because like the first thing, the only thing that you're really thinking about when you're getting players onto this Cavs roster is how do they play with LeBron?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because they've had so much trouble even developing a supporting cast that fits around LeBron. Like, even in past years, it's okay, we have JR and Tristan who basically need to play like super role players because we really don't have a whole lot else. Maybe Deli was a bench contributor, but you never really could rely on Iman Shumpert. And it makes sense that if you're just trying to find guys that fit around LeBron, that's going to be your number one priority. So you really can't build that second unit.
Yeah, and I think we've seen building around LeBron is a little more complicated than we might have thought, because now twice, and I think we'll probably get to it a little later, but like Rodney Hood, who in theory would be great around LeBron, and previously Jay Crowder, who like great 3-and-D, can kind of scrappy, do everything, guard some fours. It it didn't work out for him in Cleveland. So I think there's guys who you'd think just from their skill set would be great in this type of quote unquote system, where the system is just LeBron. But it's clear that some guys need a more defined role than that, and they're not as flexible with just, okay, I'll just fill in the gaps. They need to know exactly what they need to do, and that's something to consider going forward. And when as they try to figure out the right pieces to put with LeBron, it takes a certain kind of guy who's ready to just understand that his role is to simply play off LeBron, and that can mean different things at different times.
No, I agree. And I think one mistake that we make often as basketball fans is thinking all shooters are made the same. Like, there's some guys that are rhythm shooters that need a lot of touches. I think of even like Jamal Murray in Denver, where he didn't have great percentages in his rookie year, and some of that was abdominal issues. But when Millsap went down this year, all of a sudden you see he's getting more touches and his percentages are going up as his usage rate increases. Whereas other guys, they can just come in and catch and shoot. They don't need touches. They don't need looks. They're just pure shooters. I think that was one of the things they ran into last year with Mike Dunleavy Jr., where he needed more touches and he really struggled playing as just a shooter around LeBron. Whereas you have guys like Kyle Korver and James Jones or Channing Frye, that are just pure shooters, and those are typically the guys you need around LeBron because you're just not going to get as many touches with him.
Mm-hmm. And another part of it is you need shooters with just kind of unbreakable confidence, because I mean, it's true, because LeBron creates these really great looks for guys, but he does, if you blow the open shots that he gets you, within games, it seems like he has a fairly short leash with guys. Like, you got to hit the shots that he gets you, or at a minimum, you have to take them. And he's not going to tolerate like Jay Crowder catching an open three and then kind of hesitating yeah. and then pump faking and then swinging the ball to the next guy. It's like, you got to take the shots and you got to make them when he gets you these open shots. So that takes guys that have like, that are really, really confident and don't have that confidence waver. And I just thought that was interesting during that game, especially as I was thinking about how terrible Rodney Hood has been. It takes kind of a certain guy mentally more than on top of just like an obvious skill set. It just takes a certain mentality to be able to play off of a guy like LeBron.
Yeah, that was one of the most disappointing things for me. Like, I think where this game kind of got a little out of hand, well, I don't think, where this game got out of hand was in the fourth quarter there, where Rodney Hood, Jordan Clarkson, I think Jeff Green was out there, and Tristan Thompson, which, from the start, that is a terrible lineup, and that's putting those guys in a position to fail. But one of the things I was kind of wondering heading into the game was, okay, now that the pressure's more or less off, you have a 2-0 series lead and you're at home, maybe they use this opportunity to get Jordan Clarkson or Rodney Hood going. And I think they tried to do that because they understand that if this team is going to do anything other than get washed in the finals, you're going to need more than just LeBron and Love contributing. And those are guys that we've seen have good stretches for the Cavs this season. So I think they were trying to get them going, but the lineup was awkward. Both of those guys were just playing absolutely terrible. Even though Clarkson showed some signs of life in the first quarter, but yeah, it's just disappointing to see that those guys are still struggling in the same way here. And Hood especially, you would figure would do better with the second unit because he gets to initiate some pick and roll, but his confidence just looks shot at this moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. This is a guy that scored was averaging, 17 points a game in Utah? Like,
yeah,
he can score and he can do more than pull up 20 footers, but that seems like the only thing he's interested in doing in Cleveland. And there's just, he doesn't have that aggression going to the basket. I don't think, like, God, I can barely remember seeing him drive to the basket. and like, I don't think he's hit a three in like 9 games or something like that. He's not playing a lot these days, but yeah, I mean, it is unfortunate because like the genesis of the point that we were just talking about is that in theory, he could be great on this team. And in theory, his skill set is something that they really need.
Yeah, same with Clarkson. That's the frustrating thing. Like, these guys on paper work. Like, I understand Clarkson's a feast or famine player, but he's been starving for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you pointed out, that lineup that they ran out was, I think, is to start the fourth quarter. They were okay, so they were up 14 going into the fourth quarter. So they had some room to some wiggle room. They had some breathing room there. So yeah, they definitely could have been Ty Lue kind of experimenting with stuff, trying to get some people going. But that lineup just didn't have enough shooting around LeBron, and he fell in love with that turnaround jumper a little bit, where he started kind of taking some silly shots. But again, they're up by so much,
right?
So it's tough to criticize them too much for that little stretch. But it is when the Raptors kind of got Lowry going and they started cutting into that lead, and eventually they came all the way back.
Yeah, and the other problem there was that Toronto had benched DeMar DeRozan, and to that point, the Cavs had really been trying to get switches, trying to expose him defensively, or take advantage of him falling asleep off ball. So you had Toronto playing a lineup that was playing really well together, without kind of that obvious weak link. And the other thing that was going against them was Serge Ibaka was kind of having the game of his playoffs there. Like, that was his best performance by far on both ends of the floor. And you just kind of had all of these factors contributing to just the collapse there with Clarkson and Hood, which, as we pointed out, it's a bad situation for them, and Toronto's putting out they're putting their best foot forward. But it was the worst possible timing, but at the very least, it set up that LeBron game winner.
Yeah. And I mean, there were some, I'm not super concerned about the Raptors. Did they find something? I mean, it's 3-0, so there's not a ton they can do, but, Ananobi banked in a three, Ibaka hit a three that was like, he was standing on the wrong part of the court and Lowry kind of just like handed it to him and he hit a three. It was kind of fluky how they came back. So I'm not super concerned about that. But them playing so well without DeRozan is, it's kind of damning.
Yeah. It's a little bit interesting. And he's a guy that throughout his tenure there, that they've typically been more productive with him off the court. And I don't know if he's always going to play that bad. One of the things DeRozan does, and it's similar to LaMarcus Aldridge, is he's a workhorse. He'll shoulder a massive load offensively, and he may not do it in the most efficient manner, but by him shouldering that load, it allows everybody else to kind of play in their natural roles and makes mm-hmm. them more efficient as a result of that. And that's probably something that we do undervalue in this game. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if he's really struggling like this offensively and he's a complete liability defensively, his game just kind of devolves and he stops looking for other guys and he stops being a positive contributor. And you look at it on the night, this was a 2-point loss for Toronto where they were outscored by 23 points with DeRozan on the floor.
Yeah. And that, yeah, I mean, I had to do a double take when I looked at that number. I mean, they lost by two.
Yeah.
And they were minus 23 when he was on the court. And so
those are Isaiah Thomas numbers.
Yeah. And I knew he was bad, but that was kind of surprising to me. But it's, you're right about what his role is, where he kind of has to do that no matter what. Like, if he's on the floor, he has to try to get himself going offensively because that's what he's there for. And at a certain point, the coach can make a determination of, you know what, it's really not us worth our time and possessions of trying to get DeRozan going right now. Let's go with something else and see if we can get something else to work. And that's what Dwayne Casey did. And I think it was the right decision because you just reach a certain point in a playoff game where you have to be like, okay, we know you're our guy, but you don't have it tonight. And we can't spend more time of you trying to get your shot going or get to your spots and get in a rhythm. So let's just go with somebody else. And they had success with it.
Right. It's interesting to me because that's one of the things you have to kind of weigh as a coach in these playoff games is, okay, we are losing with one of our best players on the court, but there's also more games beyond this one. And do I lose my guy if I bench him? Like, to his credit, that's one of the things Kevin Love has done really well throughout his tenure with the Cavs, is if a different lineup is rolling, we've been able to bench him and have him come out and be aggressive and stay focused in the next game. Like, he just kind of understands that it's a matchup thing, or that he just doesn't have it on that night. But someone like DeRozan, who was dejected after the game, I'm really interested to see how he responds. Now, maybe he does respond strong. Like, I didn't think Ibaka would respond well, because he's been kind of in his own head all year. I didn't think he'd respond to being benched and out of the starting lineup well. And then he came out with one of his best games of the season. So you never know in these things. But at the same time, I don't know if DeRozan's that type of guy to bounce back in the situation.
Well, I mean, the situation is such that he has nothing to lose here. So, and you don't want that. I mean, he was 3 of 12. You don't want that to be like the last, like that final note of your season, even if the season doesn't end how you want it to. So right. I think he's going to come out and try. I mean, he's a good player. It's like, we're not talking like about a role player. This is an all-star. So I wouldn't be, and we've seen him have good games against the Cavs in the playoffs. They don't necessarily win those games, but he's gets it going from mid range, and he gets to the foul line, not as much against other teams, but he can still make things happen. So I mean, I like DeMar DeRozan. I think he'll have a good game for, and at the very least, like, he's going to shoot and he's going to try to do his thing, because like, that's what they've had success with. He's a good player. So he's got it. I don't think he's going to do anything other than what he normally does. Just to go back on, like, taking a guy out of a game like that, especially when it's a star player, I think this was a little bit different than maybe some of those situations where Twitter gets all buzz of like, oh, we got to get this guy out. But that's usually in a situation where guys, like, sometimes there's guys who are putting up numbers and being productive, but they're just hurt, killing the team. Like, if Enes Kanter could have like 30 points, but his defense is so bad that it's not worth it. Like, they're still losing those minutes that he's on the court, even if he's scoring. This wasn't right. That. DeRozan just couldn't do anything. So
yeah.
It wasn't like a hard decision where he's going off, but it's freezing out the rest of the team or anything like that. He couldn't score, and he wasn't offering much else, so he'd go with someone else.
Yeah, it's not too hard to justify that then. It's funny because this series really has felt a lot different than Toronto matchups in years past. Like, I think Toronto having Fred VanVleet there to take away some pressure from Lowry and DeRozan, and the way that they've managed those two throughout the year has helped them be more fresh. Like, you look at Kyle Lowry, and he's just been fantastic against the Cavs. He's averaging 22-8 on 63% shooting. But it's still the same thing where they've negated a lot of the other guys, and the Cavs just don't have a lot of resistance against this Raptors defense. Like, LeBron just knows what they're going to run. They're able to generate easy looks. And one thing that Ty Lue has done in almost every series, and the only one that really stands out that he didn't do this over the last few years, is against Indiana. They just hunt for mismatches. Like, they'll force you to switch. They'll find mismatches. And whether it be Kevin Love posting up guards, whether it be getting LeBron switched on to bigs, or putting your wing defenders in compromising positions, trying to chase down Korver or JR, that's one thing that the Cavs just, they don't give you a break. Like, they're always going to try to find that weak link on the court. And I think that's one of the things that made DeRozan's night look even worse.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I think that's spot on. LeBron just creates so many problems for people, and he's going to constantly find like the weak points in your defense and just go at them until they break. He's going to make you scramble. He's going to make guys do things that they're not used to doing. And if you have those guys out there, it's like when Valanciunas is out there, when DeRozan's out there, he just tries to put them in situations that makes them uncomfortable. And they just don't, those aren't so skilled players defensively that they're able to compensate. So it ends up with open shots for the Cats.
This playoffs is so backwards because it's not really backwards because it's been the trend the last few years, but I think this is the third year in a row where each playoff round gets progressively easier. Like, the Cavs always struggled in round one, even though it was a sweep. Like, there were so many games against Indiana last year that could have gone either way. Those Detroit games went down to the wire, and then they just ended up rolling on. Even though it took six games against Toronto in the conference finals, I feel like this is a better fight put up by Toronto than they did in that year. And then it looks like the Cavs are going to get Boston next round, which, as well as Boston played, I don't necessarily buy a lot of those teams that they've beat, and their best player is Al Horford. And as we've touched on earlier, he's not exactly the most effective against Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. We'll get to that later. I'm sure you guys will do a preview pod of when that series is official. But it is interesting that the Cavs kind of getting into a rhythm. They use that first – I think LeBron clearly uses that first series most of the time to kind of feel things out and start ramping up for playoff LeBron. And then I think this year they kind of just got punched in the face a little bit. That Indiana team's really good.
It is really good. And they play such a physical defense that it, as you said, it punched the Cavs in the face.
Yeah, and I think that's a good transition into what the Raptors tried to do last night they were a lot more physical with the Cavs. They were clearly like grabbing and pulling and bumping guys and just trying to prevent the Cavs from moving so freely around the court. And I'm interested in your thoughts of just how you thought that worked. It didn't change the result, but I thought it was interesting. I thought it changed kind of the feel of the game a little bit.
I think that's the way you have to play against them. That's the style of defense the Cavs have played against Golden State in the past as well, because you don't want to let Curry and Klay just kind of roam freely. Of course, the refs kind of have to allow that style being played, but I thought even though it was a physical game and they were allowing guys to be mugged, it was allowed on both ends of the floor. Of course, it's the NBA in 2018, so there's still some kind of egregious misses for both teams. I think that's the way that you kind of have to play against Cleveland, especially because they have so few guys that can initiate the offense. You have to jam cutters. You have to make people work and kind of get up in their face. And Toronto did a really, really good job of that. And I don't know if that alone was the only reason that they came back and made it such a close game. I think if the Cavs didn't go with that Hood, Clarkson, Green, Thompson lineup, they probably would have had an easier time tonight. But I think that is something we're probably going to see next game too, and it'll be interesting to see how the Cavs respond, if there's adjustments to that style now that the pardon me, I'm losing my voice, I'm all phlegmy. It'll be interesting to see if, after seeing that with Indiana and now that Toronto's done it, if there's kind of a counter to that, because they didn't really have a response against Indiana other than putting in Thompson and getting physical themselves. But it'll be interesting to see if they change things up against Toronto in game four.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the Cavs really need to change that much. But I think it is a no-brainer way for the Raptors to play it. You got to keep the Cavs from getting so comfortable, because when LeBron is comfortable and his shooters are kind of just running around off the screens, that's when he gets into kind of like Peyton Manning mode. He's just going to pick you apart.
Right.
And you just can't let that happen, because that means he gets like a head of steam going to the rim. He gets all the screens that he wants for different shooters. And then it's just, he's got like this completely spread floor. And there's nothing you can do. So you gotta get physical with them. But I think the answer that the Cavs will have is probably playing Thompson more, where you set harder screens. you do more to that kind of high pick and roll where LeBron just you just simplify the action, right? So you're not relying on Korver getting clear off of a pin down or something. You just go high pick and roll. Thompson sets a huge screen, which is most likely not a legal screen, and LeBron gets ahead of steam going down towards the basket and just say, all right, try to guard it. And most of the time they can't. But the one thing that I thought was interesting about Toronto being more physical is that, yeah, there's like more intensity. They were all over guys, but they still didn't put up very much resistance on switches. They were still like willingly switching CJ Miles onto LeBron.
Yeah, that was weird.
It's just a disaster. Like LeBron clearly, I mean, he showed what he's going to do. Like, okay, you're going to put CJ Miles on me. I'm going to go to the basket every time, and it's going to be a layup or an and one, or like I'm going to get whacked on the shoulders because that's the only play that he has left. So I think they need to kind of take the next step of that strategy of you got to fight harder on these screens to keep the guy on LeBron that you want. Like if you want Anunoby on LeBron, don't like willingly switch it at the first sign of resistance. Some of these screens that like George Hill is setting are not like monstrous screens. You can get around, yeah. You can get around him and keep your guy on him, or you can go under and just LeBron will sometimes take that shot off the pick and roll, but he doesn't usually. So I think that's probably the next thing that they need to do is just because it's like clear that CJ Miles isn't going to work on LeBron. So you got to not let that happen 20 times a game.
That's the problem. Like the Raptors usually have one player on the court that can provide resistance to either LeBron or Love. Like they don't have multiple guys like that. Like Siakam and OG are kind of those only two guys and they don't often play together. And even at that, like Siakam, you don't want guarding LeBron on the perimeter. And if OG's the primary defender on LeBron, then he can't defend Love. And the fact that they're willingly switching so frequently, it's just absolutely baffling to me. Because when you switch, especially if you're starting Van Vliet and Lowry, like the amount of post-ups Love had on point guards or shooting guards was just absolutely staggering. And as you mentioned, they also went to, okay, we're switching Miles onto LeBron, and that's just such a bad matchup for him.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's not a lot of good answers. And we saw that they switched their starting lineup for this game, right?
Yeah.
But man, those guards are just really small. Van Vliet and Lowry.
They're six like feet or six under. Feet. Yeah.
Yeah. And George Hill is not huge, but he's got a really big wingspan. And Kyle Korver and J.R. Smith are really big. Those guys are just having guys that small lowers your margin for error or shrinks it, right? So if LeBron's backing someone down, you can only get so close to him because Lowry needs more time to recover to someone, to J.R. Smith or somebody, just because he's not, his arms aren't as long and he's like not going to be able to get a contest up with if he's that far off. So it just makes things a little bit more difficult when you have guys that small. And I understand those are their best players. And Van Vliet was a plus 14 for the game. So that he was a big part of their lineups that worked. But I mean, I keep coming back to there's just no good answers. The Raptors don't have. LeBron is such a matchup problem that he can do anything on the court. They can put him at point guard and then what?
Right.
There's just not a lot of good answers. So I admire the Raptors in a sense for like being willing to try all these different things. And I think there's some criticism of Dwayne Casey of not being flexible enough. And I think we've seen, I mean, between benching DeRozan and changing your starting lineup, like that's being pretty flexible. I don't know what people want him to do because I don't think the answers are on this roster right now.
Yeah. I really feel for Casey because it feels like he has a decent chance to, if not win coach of the year, he'll probably finish like second or third. Mm-hmm. And he might end up being the scapegoat for this. Like, I don't know where Toronto goes from here. I don't know if they end up trading Lowry because he's getting up there in age or what direction they go. But they've built a hell of a team, and they are putting up a good fight this year. It's just, if you can't beat this Cavs team after all the dysfunction they've had, I just don't know how you evaluate that as a franchise, especially when you look at the future in Boston and Philadelphia, and if LeBron does end up staying in Cleveland, you have that Brooklyn pick, which is either going to turn out to be a good prospect or get traded, which I think if he stays, it's going to get traded for another All-Star. So if you're Toronto, I just don't know what your window is.
Yeah, and that gets to the unfortunate part of the NBA, where sometimes really, really good teams, like, this is what they do. And you win 50, 55 games for a handful of years in a row, and you have some good playoff series wins, but then, like, they just, their top talent isn't good enough. And it sucks to say that, because they won 59 games. Like, it's a really good team. And it's not like that Hawks team that won 60 games had all-stars, but I think Lowry and DeRozan are kind of like a little bit more impactful or higher ceiling guys than that, but it's just not, it's not enough. And they've done a really, really good job building around two guys that just aren't that top tier superstar, which means you have a ceiling. And I think we've clearly seen that the ceiling is getting to play the Cavs and then losing to LeBron. And that's, I don't think there's shame in that. Like, I agree. There's not a lot of teams that can beat, in my opinion, the best player ever when he's playing as well as he's ever played, which is what we're seeing. So, I mean, what are you supposed to do with that shot that he hit? And then go back to the last game, those fadeaways that he's hitting over guys. It's like, okay, so they have the fastest, biggest, best passer, strongest guy on the court, and he's going to hit turnaround fadeaways from 25 feet away. Like, I don't know what other teams are supposed to do.
Right. So, like, in basketball, the best team at the time of the series almost always wins the series, but there's still like those breaks that either go one way or another. Like game one, the Raptors absolutely should have won in the Cavs stole, just like, in game four of the five, or was it game four or game three where Korver missed the shot last year? Game three, right?
Yeah, game three.
Right. So like just in that game, like that could have extended the series. It's still, the result was probably inevitable, but I just feel bad for Toronto after putting up such a great season that I think this is going to end up being a sweep, and I don't know if that's indicative of how good they've played this year and how well they've played against the Cavs. But those are kind of the breaks of basketball, and it's unfortunate for them, but I don't think you can point to this team and say that they're underachievers. I think when you look at Lowry and DeRozan, they've exceeded everyone's expectations of them. And I think Toronto has established themselves as a more legitimate franchise with their ability to find young guys and develop all this talent while still being a good team. I don't think there's a lot of organizations that can do that.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've now reached the like kind of Toronto pity / respect
part. No, 100%.
Which I'm sure Toronto fans will enjoy, although they're not listening to this
podcast. Yeah, they're not 38 minutes into this podcast being like, oh, there might be a chance that they give us an Olifrant.
But I mean, I think that's right. And I think it's like I was saying, they're just the guys that they have are really good. I'm talking about Lowry and DeRozan, but I was talking about this briefly on Twitter the other day of just the matchups. It's not good because neither of them can guard LeBron. And we've seen in the past, the teams that have a star that can also kind of hold their own against LeBron, those are the ones that can at least give the Cavs trouble. Jimmy Butler with the Bulls comes to mind, Paul George with the Pacers. When you have that guy who's your star player, so he can kind of he can guard LeBron at least a little bit and make life difficult for him. And I mean, those two guys I just named are like elite defenders. So they're elite against anybody, and then they can come on kind of cause some problems for LeBron with their Jimmy's really strong and Paul George is really, really long and quick. There's really great hands. That makes the matchup a little more interesting, but those are not the guys that Toronto has. Toronto has two star players that don't really bother LeBron at all defensively, and that's just a really big problem, especially when LeBron can then switch on to either one of them whenever he wants and make their life a nightmare. So
that's not a formula for success, is what you're trying to say.
And right, and so it's partly just a bad matchup, partly maybe sort of bad roster composition in hindsight. Which is not, I mean, in the NBA, you're just trying to get, like, if you get two.
You just try to get talent, right?
But maybe something to keep in mind. I think it's sort of what we're seeing in Boston a little bit, where they've clearly gone out to get these big wings. And the Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum are like huge, skilled wings. That's the direction the NBA is going. And especially, I mean, we'll see if it works or if it makes a difference, but that's what you need against LeBron, and the Warriors do it. And Boston, I think, is kind of recognized that the way the NBA is going is everyone's going to be 6'8" and super skilled and be able to switch on everybody and have arms everywhere and get in passing lanes and stuff like that. And that's just not how the Raptors are built right now.
Yeah. It's just remarkable where we're at now compared to a week ago, where we're game seven against Indiana, and now like the mentality's just completely changed. Now I'm back to rooting for the Rockets so that the Cavs can have a chance in the finals, because as I've said before, I feel good two stars, all stars versus two all stars with having LeBron on our side. I think that's a much more favorable scenario than whatever the hell that Golden State death machine is. So do you have any kind of parting thoughts before we wrap this up, Conrad? God, I almost called you Carter. That's the meanest thing I've done on this podcast.
I wish Carter's in like Italy right now. That doesn't sound so bad.
Yeah. He's fine dining at Olive Garden in Italy.
Gosh, parting thoughts. I mean, I don't think we want to spend more time on Toronto. I am interested to see like what they do going forward. I think this game four will be interesting. I wonder if they have another lineup change or if Dwayne Casey kind of just sticks with what he did. Cause I think their idea was right. I just don't know if it, I don't know if I'd have Valanciunas in the starting lineup. Maybe just go really small and see what happens. You don't really have anything to lose. So
It'd be interesting to see like Ibaka, OG, DeRozan, Van Vliet, and Lowry, or even CJ Miles in instead of Van Vliet. Like I think those type of lineups would be interesting.
Yeah, and I think I just think from the Cavs perspective, I think Tristan will probably play more in Game Four. I think if they recognize that this is going to be physical and it's kind of like it's. I think the Raptors are. I know we talk a lot about how the Cavs have demoralized them and LeBron's in their head, but I think they're going to put up a fight in this last game. I don't think any Raptors fans really want to go to that game five if they end up winning this one. I feel like that's kind of cruel, but I think the team will put up a fight. So I think the Cavs are going to have to earn this if they want to sweep. So usually when it gets like kind of gritty and like a down and dirty game, Tristan Thompson comes in handy. He just gets you extra possessions. He sets those huge screens, like I said. So I just think we'll probably see him play some more. But if Kevin Love plays like he did tonight, then they'll be in good shape.
Yeah, keeping Kevin Love on this level of production is really, really important for them. But thank you so much, Conrad, for coming on and filling in for Carter. And putting up with my BS, so I appreciate that. Do you have anything to plug for the people, or just your Twitter?
Just my Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. Just keep watching LeBron. Just appreciate what you're watching. It's every night he goes out and does something that you've never seen before, and we're just lucky that he plays for our favorite team. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's the thing. We don't know what the future holds. I will say, and Carter had mentioned this earlier, after the game winner against Indiana, I know it's meaningless and we'd mock this if other fans said that, but having two moments where LeBron jumps up on the scorer's table and is kind of like embracing the city, that just makes me feel better about him hanging around. And that's completely irrational, but it's just something that it's hard not to think that way.
Yeah, and I urge people to, and I agree with you. Yeah, it looks good, and it looks like he's enjoying it, and that's what you want. But I do urge people to just kind of sometimes try to look at it without that framing of don't worry about where he's going. Just
enjoy. That's the thing. Nobody knows what he's going to do at the way he thinks. Not even him, probably, at this point.
Yeah, there's no way to know. Just enjoy it. Just watch. Just sit back and enjoy the greatness. It's you're not going to see it again. It's just really cool. It's really special.
Absolutely. So thank you again. Follow Conrad on Twitter at ConradKaz. Thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can support the show by subscribing, leave a rating, leave a review. It's the best way to help people find us and to help the show grow. So thank you, guys. We'll probably have a podcast up after this round is over, unless it gets extended, which I'm kind of hoping against right now. But thanks again, guys. Until next time, go Cavs.